Proving your father wrong is a really good motivation.
From Foundation Capital, this is How to B2B a CEO, the show about how to scale your enterprise startup and how to grow from founder to CEO. I'm Ashu Garg, general partner at Foundation Capital. On the show today, we have Nick Mehta, who's a close friend for over a decade and is the CEO of Gainsight. That's really created a category on customer success. I first met Nick over 10 years ago at Trinity Ventures when we were both EIR sharing a tiny little room.
That was a small office. We got to know each other really well.
We did.
That was fun. Yeah.
And the thing I really remember about Nick is the fact that he was the most organized networker I've ever met. 10 years later, that's still true. You had a spreadsheet of 1,000 people.
Oh my gosh!
And you were meeting 15 people a day, and I remember sort of saying, "This is my role model, and this is how I'm going to be an EIR."
It's a lot of Starbucks. It was 100%. Yeah, that was all about volume.
And what did you learn in that process? What was the most fun part, and how did that take
you to
where you are today?
Yeah, it's interesting because I think that if you're in B2B. A lot of the business is not just technology, it's personal, right? It's people, because you're selling to companies and you know, the people and companies. And honestly, I'm just very curious about people. I enjoy meeting people, learning their stories and their backgrounds. And at that time, that was meeting entrepreneurs and VCs, and now it's meeting people in our customer community. But I just learned that I love meeting people. I think if you're in B2B, to do it long-term, you got to love people.
And that's one of the things I really sort of learned, I think, in sort of watching you sort of as an EIR, because you were transitioning out as I was transitioning in.
Right.
And you had this interesting knack of being able to connect with people on the technology side, and they respected you for that. And you have a long background at Symantec, and you've gone really deep into managing sort of infrastructure stuff on the product management side.
Right.
And at the same time, you really connected with people. And it, you know, whether it was an engineer who had ADHD, who could barely speak, or a sales guy, you know, the nerd to the jock, you sort of managed that entire spectrum well.
Yeah, no, I think I just find every person has their story, and whether it's a VC like yourself, right, or just a normal person, you know, the reality is everyone has their story, and I think I love running a company because there's so many stories you get to know inside the company and outside, and I just feel like if you approach people with curiosity and really try to understand who they are and who their company are, that you'll sell better, you'll build better stuff, and hopefully you'll feel better too.
And so tell me a little bit of how that transition happened from meeting, you know, almost 1,000 people as an EIR at Trinity to starting off at Gainsight.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. My story with Gainsight actually strangely starts in my childhood. You may not have heard the story, but my dad was actually an executive and he ran some small companies. And he worked in technology back in the 80s and 90s. He worked at this company called Digital Equipment, which you and I probably remember, but some of the listeners may not know. It's an old computer company. It's a bit of an age test. And Digital Equipment, you know, was a kind of traditional computer company where, you know, build stuff and then they would ship it and they'd sell it. Mm-hmm. And when I was a kid, my dad said, if you ever go into business, you need to make sure that you're either the person building something or you're the person selling something, because everything else is overhead. It doesn't matter, you know, support, services, doesn't matter, right? And it's funny because, you know, obviously with what we're doing in Gainsight, which I'll talk more about, you know, we're really trying to change that. But that's really the history of business historically.
So you started Gainsight because your dad said there's nothing in between and you wanted to prove him wrong?
Proving your father wrong is a really good motivation. Now, my dad later on claims through revisionist history that he always has been a fan of customer success. So, like many people have told me. But the quick version is I you know, was a kid, then I did my own startup. I was in the consumer world. Then I worked at Symantec, which is a great, you know, enterprise software company. But traditional business model was about building and selling. Then I went to run my first SaaS business, this company, Live Office, which I ran and then sold. And in running that company, I realized in these subscription business models where customers have so much power, if you just build and sell, you're never going to actually keep those customers for the long term and really capture the economics and the model. And so after selling my last company, I took some time off and I got a call from a friend who was investing in Gainsight very early. And honestly, the company was way earlier than I wanted to go join because I was looking.
I remember that. I mean, you wanted to go to an established
late
company,
stage,
go scale it,
something set up, and it's just
low
like
risk.
Jump in. And you know, he called me and said, yeah, it's 17 people or 16, I guess, before I got there. And it was, you know, basically $100,000 of revenue or something. But, you know, honestly, I fell in love with the idea because I'd felt that pain firsthand of like, how do you manage your customers when they have so much power? And that was about 5 years ago.
That's very cool. So tell us a little bit about the process of jumping into a company that had some history, 16 people, and yet was very early. And it wasn't obvious that there was a big business here at the time.
Yeah, it's really interesting because I feel like, you know, when you're, I mean, I really think the best businesses, the people that are running them, whether you're founder or CEO, you have to like really believe. I mean, I know that sounds so trite, but I meet a lot of companies where I think people approach it a little more academically. And because I'd run my own subscription business, SaaS business, and because I had that sort of childhood, my dad talking about building and selling, I had my own story of why I really believed. And there was very little at Gainsight, but we had some great people and we all really believed and I believed. And so I think we just had that shared belief from day one. And I met the two founders. We also shared the value, the kind of our definition of values. We use different words, but we have the same kind of core beliefs on values. So kind of believing in the mission, believing in the values, honestly, there was like, it was just immediately such a obvious
fit. It was love at first sight.
Yeah, totally. It was just like, I felt like this has just been my life. And honestly, that's just, it is my life's mission from a business perspective. And, you know, I'm really committed to what we do.
So tell me about the early days, because I remember when you first joined Gainsight, there was no such thing as a category for customer success. And most people that I talked to at the time would say, hey, this is probably a feature, maybe a product.
Totally.
But it'll be a small outcome is, I think, the common belief in the Valley. And you've proven a lot of people wrong over the last 5 years.
Absolutely. I mean, 5 years ago, customer success didn't pass what I would call the grandparent test of, like, you can explain it to people. And even today, you know, still trying to explain it. But we've come a long way. Actually, I would say I'm proud that my kids finally understand what I do. My son, my 9-year-old son understands customer success at a high level now, which is pretty cool. But, you know, 5 years ago, as you said, Ashu, nobody thought it was a category. I mean, some people might have said, oh, yeah, SaaS companies want to, you know, look for churn, and maybe that's a feature of some other system, you know. And I guess I just felt the problem firsthand in my last business, so I knew it was a big problem. And I feel like for a lot of business, I think you want to create something great. Sometimes you need the information advantage that you know it's a big problem, but nobody else does. And so honestly, we were motivated in the early days, and still to some extent, by the fact that people think it's more niche than we think it actually is. And so that actually, we kind of wear that on our sleeves. We're proud of that.
And for some of our listeners who may not know what customer success is and who may not know what your 9-year-old knows, give us the 9-year-old definition of customer success.
The 9-year-old, actually, the family talks about it as, you know, Starbucks wants to make sure that people keep coming back to Starbucks, and there's lots of all the other places you can go, right? And how do you get people to actually come back? And that's obviously a trite consumer example. If you're running a B2B business, almost everyone in the podcast probably knows that, you know, your customers, whatever they spend with you initially, there's probably a lot more they're going to spend with you over time, whether that's by renewing their contracts or expanding what they've bought. You know, the initial purchase they have with you is probably a fraction of what people call their lifetime value. And so for a lot of businesses, they have processes to maximize the acquisition of customers and to get more leads and to actually build their customers better, all these other business processes, but they have no business process to maximize customer lifetime value. How do you actually make sure that the customer stays with you, spends more money over time, and ideally becomes an advocate so they're telling other people about what you do? Customer success is all about that, driving retention of customers, expansion of their spending, and advocacy. And the way you do that is by really understanding what that customer's desired outcomes are, what they're looking for from your product or service, and then making sure your whole company is mobilized to get them to the value they're looking for.
Got it. That's very helpful. So let's go back to sort of the early days. You jumped into a company. Most people don't think there's a real category here. You feel the pain though, and you believe, and you have as your partner a founder who also believes, and all of 17 people.
Yeah, so right.
What was that like? How did that start, and how did you get from there to where you are today?
Yeah, well, it's interesting because I definitely there's probably for people that are in those early stage companies, the emotions are everything. So like the emotions where you're an early stage company are like, nobody, at least for me, nobody really cares about what we're doing, right?
Yep.
Nobody's calling us. Like nobody's like, there's the phone's not ringing, you know? Like we had a little office in Castro Street in Mountain View, California, in sort of downtown above a bar, like this kind of like right above a bar, they like leased their space
out.
Well,
that's perfect for you.
And it was great. Yeah, exactly. Well, that's
bar meetings.
Yeah, I think you would enjoy that too, from what I remember.
Absolutely.
And so, you know, we were in this office and it was super, I mean, on one hand, we all nostalgically look back on those days. So if you're in that early stage, you should know that people like me, we're about 500 people now at Gainsight, you know, we look back on that phase as just like the most fun, right? Because it's, I mean, it's just such a small, everyone's together. Every single deal is so celebrated, right? Like we'll close like a $10,000 deal and we're like gonna go out for drinks and probably spend more on the drinks than the deal, right? And so, but you know, it was that very special time. You're working on very trivial things like I spent half a day figuring out how to make the Wi-Fi work in the office. You know, like those very early days.
Well, knowing you, it definitely was a half a day problem.
Yeah, it was complicated.
Your technical skills, huh?
Yeah, exactly. They've really gotten waned over the years. But you know, I think the thing that is really interesting is all those little things matter a lot. You know, the deal that you won, the deal that you lost, the person that chose you, the person that didn't. Every one of those things, you know, matter. They still matter now. Mm-hmm. But of course, the volume is a lot bigger. And so I think in those early days, you're just trying to get people to care and notice, right? Like you're just trying to those little things to get people to notice, and every one person matters. So that's something I would say is repeatable, which is every person you meet, whether it's an investor, a customer, a potential employee, matters to your advocacy.
So that's great. One or two other tips that you would give people who are, you know, the most companies I invest in have 10, 15 employees, so yeah. Very much where you were at Gainsight, and probably have less than 10 customers at that
yeah,
point.
Yeah, exactly. We're the same.
And it's a struggle. Like, you know, customers don't want to buy because totally. They're looking for referenceable customers. You're constantly hearing the, hey, unless you have 40, 50 customers, I'm not going to sign up. So what did you do in the early days that got you started?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think everyone starts a little bit with their friends or friends of friends or friends of investors, and we were no different, right? You get that initial sort of like, okay, who is willing to try our stuff out and give us a break and things like that. And, you know, if you've read things like Jeffrey Moore, he talks about those, you know, people that are the early visionaries that actually kind of, if you think about it, these are the people that themselves get benefit out of trying new things out. So one tip practically is the people that are on the websites as references for other vendors are likely to be the people that will try your stuff
out. That's a great tip.
If you looked at the early companies of almost every SaaS, early customers of every SaaS company, I think they're quite similar because some customers are by themselves innovative and willing to take risk. So that's one example. The last one I'd throw out is just like a practical tip. If really, like really minutia but practical. In the early days, some things will go well and some things won't. I think though times when things don't go well, the way you treat people can really help in the future. So the customer that doesn't choose your product or that churns off of you, how do you treat them? You know, as an example,
they come back and
they come back later. Yeah. We honestly, like there was a customer early on that churned, and you know, we sent them like a gift basket to thank them for all the stuff they did with us, right? Versus just being pissed off. Obviously, we were annoyed, right? But then later on, they came back, right? Or the teammate that didn't choose you and they had a couple options. Yeah. Do you stay in touch with them, right? The investor that didn't choose you, you know, those kinds of things. How do you treat the people that didn't go with you and how do you keep them kind of in your network?
We'll be right back.
If you're listening to this podcast, you're probably the kind of nerd who understands that encryption is one of the most popular and effective ways of protecting data. But even if encrypted at rest and in motion, did you also know that data are still vulnerable to attacks when an application starts to run? Wow, you are a nerd. When was the last time you were on a date? Well, that's where Fortanix comes in. Not with finding you a date. No technology can do that. What Fortanix does do is protect your data even when it's in use. We call it runtime encryption. With runtime encryption, your data are encrypted and safe even when in use by applications. Fortanix. We can't help you secure a date, but we can help you secure your data. Visit Fortanix.com to learn more about runtime encryption, our provable, portable, preventive security solution.
Talk a little bit about what it's been like to be a CEO. Most people talk about how it can be lonely. On the other hand, you know, it feels very glamorous from the outside. So talk about that journey as a CEO yourself, both in the early days and how it's evolved over time.
I think there's truth in all the different emotions. So like in my head, you know, I think you have to be willing to almost hold opposing your ideas in your head at the same time, right? I think that's a really interesting way to live. And so I hold two ideas in my head. One is it's a stressful, lonely job and it's hard to find people to connect to. And the flip side is it's a freaking totally privileged job and I'm so lucky to have it. It's the best job you could possibly have. And I'm so thankful, and I could not possibly imagine like
doing anything else
or complaining about relative to what other people have to deal with, right? And so I love my job; it's amazing, right? And it changed so much over the years. You know, in the early days, you know, I think one big thing that's changed from then to now is, you know, your ability to make individual impact on individual initiatives.
Yep.
is higher in the early days, right? Like I fixed the Wi-Fi. We talked about that before, right? Or, you know, I could say, hey, I could go help get that customer, and that deal was meaningful because, yep, you know, we had three deals that quarter and I got one of them, right? And so you can have a really big impact on individual things. And as you go later, you can have an impact too on individual things, but of course, like relative order of magnitude, that starts going down. And you start thinking like, what do I do? What's my job? Like, I think a lot of CEOs wrestle with this. If you're in that phase of maybe you're 100 people now or 200 people, it's like, what do I do? Like, I can't just go like code a new feature and have the same relative impact, or I can't go close a customer.
So what did you change?
So one of the things I changed is, I kind of in my head think of like two basic blocks, right? Of I can work on, or maybe three broadly, I can work on the processes and systems and kind of strategy, right?
So process, systems, and strategy.
Right. So I got really focused on, like, we have a very disciplined strategic planning process and the goal setting, and with 500 people that matters because they're all going
Absolutely.
In a certain direction, right? I can do that. I can actually impact people still a lot because, you know, when I spend time with employees or talk at an all hands or go talk to a customer conference, like that really does have an impact.
And Absolutely.
In some ways it has a higher impact because you're the CEO of a more higher profile company than before, right? So you have power there, right? And then number three, I think you can push the company to go do something new, like, but it can't be 100 different things, right?
So then you pick one,
right? So I always have my like pet project that's on my list of, you know, this is the thing we're not doing that I think we should be, and I'm researching it, and I'm meeting entrepreneurs to learn what they're doing and how we can partner with them or whatever. Like, I'm trying to figure out that next thing. So for me, the systems and processes, the people, and then the next thing.
You've hit on an important point, because I think for a lot of CEOs who make it through the crawl phase and sort of getting the first tens of customers, as they get into the walk or run phases, you know, they seem to hit a ceiling. And
yes.
it seems like, you know, all the things they were doing till then didn't matter as much anymore, and they don't know what to do anymore.
Totally.
They're still trying to chase that extra deal. There's just too many of deals to chase. They're still trying to chase that one extra feature. And again, there's 100 new features to add. It doesn't move the meter for the company.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
What advice would you have for people that are going through that transition?
One very practical advice is to come up with a system for setting up the strategy and goals. So I know it's very tactical, but like this past year at Gainsight, we implemented a system. The term is OPSP, one-page strategy plan. It's in a book called Scaling Up. And whether you use that or you use OKRs, which is another term that people use, objectives and key results, or there's a term V2MOM, which is another goal-setting framework, or whatever one you have, come up with a framework for how the company is going to run.
That makes sense.
And really like do some research to figure out which one fits you, and then go all in on that. I spent the last 6 months at Gainsight literally working on a two-page document. It's a one-page strategy, two sides of one page. And it's literally everything that we're working on the next year. And every word
is font size 4?
Yeah, font size 8. But every word has been scrutinized by me, and every number has been checked. And this is my work now, right? And this is the thing that everyone, our fiscal year starts on February 1st. And so this is the thing that's going to mobilize everyone. So go figure out your system for running the company.
The thing that really resonated for me is this notion of really writing your strategy down.
Yes.
In one or two pages.
Nailed it.
A 50-page book, because no one's going to remember pages. But also not a PowerPoint, because you can get away with a lot of fuzziness in a PowerPoint.
I'm so glad you said that. You're right. I think the written word, and off Amazon, as some people know, is really extreme on this, where every meeting has a memo that you have to write beforehand. But the written word forces intellectual clarity. So.
And have you sort of had that culture permeate through
the
rest of the team?
No, I don't think so. It's interesting, because that's something I've thought about. And you know, one of the other things that's interesting, to just as a learning for me, is, you know, the institutions that you create in your company, you know, how you do meetings, or whether you're on time, or whether you do a memo before the meeting, or whether you use PowerPoint, or your values, you actually like have to get a lot of them right early.
Yep.
And then as you get bigger, you can change very few things at once. So for example, right now I could choose to make the memo writing the thing, right? But I couldn't choose to make the memo writing thing and say we all need to be on time for meetings, or that we all need to do X, right? Like I can only pick
one thing
cultural change at any given time.
The culture that you set early on, and we talked about this earlier in this podcast, was really customer centric.
Yes.
Was values based.
Right.
Was really about sort of caring not just about customers, but also about people within the company,
That's
their
right.
families. So how did you sort of go through that process of defining a culture? How has that evolved from the crawl phase early on to sort of scaling now?
Totally. Yeah, I'll kind of describe it in maybe three chapters. So Chapter one was in the very beginning, we defined the values of the company as we were just getting started, literally my first week or something. And I think values have to come from the founder, CEO, whoever's like in charge. And so for me, our first three values were golden rule, treat people the way you want to be treated, because that's just something personally important to me. Childlike joy, which I mentioned before, and then success for all, driving business that drives balanced success, right? And so those three things weren't some like consultant that came in and told us, here's the value.
It was you.
It was me. And now everyone else was on board with it, obviously, right? But that was kind of nice because everyone since that day has been hired with those presumptions and, you know, we really believe in them. It's not just marketing. And so that was like chapter one, right? Chapter two is actually then saying as you're scaling, like, looking at those values again and saying, are we missing anything? Do we want to revise them? And so when we were about maybe 150, 200 people, we said, okay, what are we missing anything? And I joke that golden rule, childlike joy and success for all, somebody could think we're running a bed and breakfast. So we actually are also a business. And so what are we missing? And so we had a really great offsite with maybe now 30 or 40 people, like kind of the leadership team, extended leadership. And also I picked some people that weren't even extended leadership but represented the values, you know, sort of those people that you really, and we basically like came up and said, okay, there's these two things missing. And one was about intellectual curiosity and one was about ambition. Sure. And so we ended up using, but we wanted very personal things that resonated. So our fourth and fifth value were Shoshin, which means beginner's mind, and that intellectual curiosity kind of in a way. And then stay thirsty, my friends, which if you've watched that commercial for this beer, Dos Equis, is like a kind of a little funny saying, but it's about like the internal thirst and drive, right? But those values like still were very personal and I was super involved in them. I chose the final wording. And then the third phase that we're in now, which is, okay, now how do you keep that going? So we're actually doing our company kind of kickoff, where we bring everyone together, right? And we're going to do another values training, right? Like it never stops. And we're going to talk about how do you make values in action at the scale we're at? How do you, as a manager, how do you manage with values? You're creating training classes on each value. You know, you're really like, if you believe in this. And I would say just the bottom line is don't do this stuff if you don't believe in it. I really like... It kind of breaks my heart that there's all these companies out there that like tell their employees they care about these values and the employees
and there's nothing behind that sort of facade.
It's a total scam, right? So you should totally do what you believe in, like in your heart.
You know, one of the things you mentioned, which really sort of struck a chord for me again, was this notion of doing it yourself and leading from the front. I mean, I have found whenever I have a portfolio company that says, hey, we brought in a consultant to help us think through values or help us think through one of my companies and, you know, This was an early sign I wish I had recognized at the time, was they had a consultant write up a values book.
Oh, my gosh.
And it, you know, it really tells you that it's not coming from within. It's and the employees feel that.
Totally.
It was so inauthentic. And the employees came back, you know, to me a year later and said, look, we just don't believe what the CEO is saying. It's just, it doesn't ring true. And the lack of authenticity in the values then sort of, you know, permeates across everything else they say.
I'm so glad you said that, Ashu, because I think that that's another tip I'd give is like your credibility with your employees is everything. And, you know, you think about your external constituents, like your investors or your customers, but your constituents are your employees as well, and maybe the most important. And every single time you do something that's in contrast with what you say, you're just taking away a little bit of that bank, and eventually you have no credibility left, you know? Then they don't go do what you say, and they don't believe in what you believe, and they leave. So that don't ever compromise
that credibility. You're a super warm, affable guy. You know, a lot of the people stuff comes naturally to you. And so much that you've talked about in this podcast has been applying that intensity around people, that emotion and that energy, both internally within the company and externally. What do you do if you're just not naturally a people person?
Yeah.
You're more like me.
So I think that in the company, there needs to be that capability, but it doesn't have to be the CEO, right? And so I think there's some great companies out there where the COO or president or head of sales is that person that's out there in the community. And I think they just have to be empowered. You know, I mean, obviously the Mark Zuckerberg, Sheryl Sandberg is the ultimate example of that, right?
Of that.
But I think every company has that, right? Not every company, the CEO. Even some CEOs who are not technical, they're more numbers oriented. They're not the extrovert.
No, everyone uses the Mark, Sheryl Sandberg example. It's the canonical example. But, you know, when you're a multi-billion dollar success from almost day one.
Yeah, right.
Those examples are easy.
Sheryl
Sandberg's happy being number two at
Totally.
Facebook. The challenge I find is most of these number two executives aren't really happy being number two. They want to be the CEO. Then.
Yeah.
How do you manage that dynamic in those situations, you think?
My gut feeling, I mean, I think it's a good question that there's a lot of challenge with that COO, CEO thing in general. But my opinion is that external person doesn't even have to be the COO or the Sheryl Sandberg equivalent. They can be a executive, but somebody who's just external and really loves connecting with the community, right? They could be your head of marketing. They could be your head of VP of sales. They could be your product person. It doesn't actually matter what the role is, but I think a big thing is like empowering them. So for example, you know, the blog is their blog. The podcast that they do is their podcast.
Their podcast.
They are the one invited to speak at the conferences. Like, just go all in on somebody, right? And make them the voice of
the
company. It could be you. It could be somebody else.
If you look back on the last 5 years, what are the one or two things you wish you had done differently in addition to getting a CFO sort of earlier than you actually did?
Yeah, I mean, so the CFO earlier is part of a larger story, which is, I think, in category creation, there's a lot of waste. Right? In any startup, there's waste. I mean, let's be honest, right? Like, not every decision. I mean, I'm sure all your companies are 100%
dialed in. Oh, my companies are all perfect.
The other companies that don't have the benefit of Ashi on the board, like, you just end up, in hindsight, wasting money, right? You waste money on the event that you shouldn't have done, or the salesperson you shouldn't have hired, or the whatever, right? And you also waste time because it takes you longer. And so I think a disciplined metrics orientation, which is usually embodied in a financial plan, which is usually implemented by CFO, is the way to reduce waste and time in you getting to the promised land. So that's like one big, big thing I would say. It's not about hiring a CFO. It's about having a disciplined planning process that reduces waste and improves predictability and accelerates the cycle of learning, if you will. I think that's like one huge thing I would do.
In addition to having a people person, get a numbers guy or gal in the company.
Exactly, yeah, somebody that can really be that. And then I think the third thing is the culture. If you are passionate about the culture yourself, at some point you become the bottleneck because everything depends on you, right? And so having that people person, the chief people officer, HR leader, who can be your partner to help scale that culture and to make it institutional versus just like you like personally making it happen, right?
You know, we started off by talking about how you started this company to prove your father wrong. Have you proven him wrong?
You know, like I said, I think that my dad is always good at converting the past to make himself right. I love my dad. I've learned so much from him. He really does actually now believe in customer success, and hopefully one day everyone will.
That's it for this episode. You can find past episodes and subscribe to future ones on iTunes, Stitcher, and SoundCloud. How to B2B a CEO is brought to you by Foundation Capital, an early stage venture capital firm with 27 IPOs, including Netflix, Lending Club, TubeMogul, and Sunrun. I'm Ashu Garg, a general partner at Foundation Capital. I'm passionate about helping B2B entrepreneurs who are trying to solve hard problems. So if this podcast speaks to you, if you're interested in growing from a technical founder into a business leader, drop me a line. Thanks, and see you next time.